This is Wally Knox. Welcome to the Political Conversation. In today's episode of the Political Conversation, I sit down for a fascinating talk with a banker. Is that even possible? And not just any banker, with Stephen Roach, who was the chief economist of one of the largest banks ever, Morgan Stanley, and who then led the bank deep into business in China. And we don't for a moment talk about banks and banking as a business. Rather, we dive straight into his serious criticisms of the governance of the United States Federal Reserve System. And then we turn to China and its prospects. Roach does not see those two topics as separate. He's outlined a deep relationship between the two, and his views are not formed from some book he read somewhere sometime. He lived the issues he discusses in the Fed and in China. Before we turn to that conversation, I should make a comment about the climate around considerations of China these days. It's gloomy out there. The prevailing climate is pessimism about the potential for cooperation, so there's a run for the bunkers. We debate how strongly we should pull away from trade and mutual investment with China, not whether pulling away is the right direction. We debate how much to increase the defense budget, not whether there should be an increase. Pessimism comes easy. But my instinct is that where pessimism comes so darn easy, we're not getting something right. Roach pushes back strongly on that pessimism, but not from the perspective of a starry-eyed idealist, rather from the perspective of a clear-eyed, realistic banker. It's time to meet Stephen Roach. I'm going to dive into it. One of your recent essays caught my attention, and you wrote that China benefits from our financial debacles. I think this was one of your recent essays in Project Syndicate. And I want to go into your views on that in depth. I'd like to begin discussing the role of the Federal Reserve in dealing with our financial difficulties and creating our financial difficulties in your view, and then turn to what all that's in your view signifies for China. You have been severely critical of the Federal Reserve for being content to run negative interest rates for years on end. But when I talk to folks about the issue, there are few people I talk to who understand what a negative interest rate is. So getting to the basics becomes difficult in that discussion. It's pretty simple. What's your view? How do you explain that to folks quickly and simply?
Well, first of all, I don't want to come across as a somebody who really has a serious problem with the Federal Reserve as an institution. My first job coming out of grad school was to work at the Federal Reserve in the 1970s. And during that period, it was a very tough period for the Fed. I learned how to apply my trade as an economist under the leadership of arguably one of the worst central bankers the Fed ever had, Arthur Burns, who really, because of a series of mistakes, ran a monetary policy that condoned a massive buildup of inflation and took, you know, the courageous act and the very tough medicine of Paul Volcker to address. And what I think was engraved in my consciousness, Wally, is that there were some similarities, 50 years later, in the way in which Jerome Powell, who I have great respect for, reacted to a sharp acceleration of inflation in the aftermath of COVID and all the disruptions that occurred to supply chains and other aspects of our economy that bore a striking similarity to mistakes that Arthur Burns made in the early 1970s. And so I became apoplectic. I wrote about this early on in the COVID period, my first critical essay that drew the connection was called The Ghost of Arthur Burns. And I argue that I am forever and to this very day haunted by the mistakes that were made back in the 70s and dismissing the early warnings of inflation as transitory. And that was a word that Jerome Powell and Janet Yellen and other very knowledgeable policymakers used to describe the tendency this time. And so the Fed stuck to its guns and held its overnight policy rate, the federal funds rate, incredibly low during COVID and kept it there in the aftermath of COVID when inflation was surging and what they thought would be a temporary surge. And when that turned out to be wrong, lo and behold, they woke up and found out that their policy rate was well below a surging inflation rate. And that's what we call a negative real interest rate, when inflation is well in excess of the policy rate that you charge banks for overnight lending. And, you know, we're still there today in negative territory, but only slightly. And, you know, hopefully that will go away soon. But we are in the longest period of negative inflation in modern history. And, you know, as the Fed belatedly recognized the error of its ways and moved to correct it, and as I said, it still hasn't fully done that, the financial system has suffered a lot of really difficult adjustments in acclimating itself to a more normal monetary policy. And the failure of Silicon Valley Bank is one of those, a manifestation of how difficult it is for financial institutions to adjust.
So I was trying to figure out how to make a negative rate vivid to folks who haven't lived with the issue. And I was just doing a mental exercise of saying, if I borrow $100 at a 2% interest rate, but there's 3% inflation, and I pay off my debt a year later, the consequences to me in the real world are not that I have had to pay 102 fully real dollars. Those $102 have to be deflated. And when inflation exceeds the interest rate, I can end up making a little bit of money on the deal.
There you go. That's the best way to put it. You are, the outstanding value of your loan is being inflated more than the interest rate you are paying on the original nominal value of the loan. So you're basically getting paid to borrow money by the central bank. It's not a bad deal.
It's not a bad deal at all. And I mean, there are, you know, I pause and wonder, well, if it's not a bad deal at all, what's the problem? No, it's so easy to argue that low interest rates are beneficial to the economy. It allows an entrepreneur to begin. It allows an established enterprise to expand. I have a great idea. I need to borrow money to do it. The lower the interest rate on my loan, the better. And if I get a negative interest rate, oh my gosh, I can borrow a whole bunch of money, try out my idea, and even if it fails, come away with a little bit in my pocket. But there are dangers in that. And I think it's very difficult for the public to really understand that. Is there a way for you to crystallize the dangers?
Yeah, I mean, if something is too good to be true, usually you find out painfully the price of getting suckered into that false belief. And when interest rates are too low, and, you know, in the case of the example and the reality we're using, below zero in inflation adjusted terms, you ultimately do, you run the risk of a couple of things. Number one, the inflation rate itself starts to accelerate, as we've seen in the last few years, because the Federal Reserve does not have a negative real interest rate the type of control over the economy that it needs to supply its promise to Congress of price stability. You've got too much money sloshing around in the system. And the Fed didn't do this just with its interest rate tool. It expanded its balance sheet, injecting liquidity through, you know, a procedure that we've technically dubbed quantitative easing. And that has added, you know, if anything, you know, more fuel to the inflationary flame. So it's a double whammy. The final thing that happens, though, is that in a zero or, you know, too low of an interest rate environment, all the other assets that are in our system get inflated in value because they look so attractive relative to the low deposit rates you get in your bank account. So asset owners rush into stocks, they rush into bonds, they rush into homes, and that rush then results oftentimes, as we've seen repeatedly over the last 25 years, a series of asset bubbles that people borrow against. You know, you borrow against your ever appreciating home value, in some cases against your stock values, and you get a dangerous confluence of an asset bubble together with ever rising debt. And one thing we know about bubbles is they always pop. There's never a time, by definition, when a bubble doesn't go to excess and pops. And then when that happens, you know, you really have a much more serious price to pay in terms of the implications on the asset markets and the real economy that's become so dependent on asset-based spending by consumers and businesses alike. So, you know, when you're running an aggressively easy monetary policy, as our central bank has done for a long, long time, you're basically playing with fire. And, you know, the crises that we've seen, beginning, I'd say, with the bursting of the dot-com bubble in 2001, are a very visible manifestation of how dangerous that fire can become from time to time.
So I thought I would ask you to spend a moment going back to the 1970s. You and I lived through the era of the 1970s when inflation was massive and enduring. We have inflation bothering us currently because it's been around for about a year. But the inflation in the 1970s was massive in its rate and astonishing in its duration. What did it, you know, it went on for years, I guess, is what I'm simply trying to say. People got so darn used to it that they were alternatively terrified of what would happen to their paychecks in the next year or so and scrambling to get increases in order to keep up. What did that massive dislocation feel like to the folks inside the Fed at that time?
Well, you're going to force me to go back and, you know, relive a difficult, traumatic experience as a young economist. I do remember the 70s very painfully. You and I are old enough also to have lived through the 60s, but I always keep in mind that the old adage of Timothy Leary, who said, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there.
You weren't there.
So let's fast forward to the 1970s because we were both there, and I definitely, unlike the 60s, remember what happened then. The main problem was that the central bank did not believe that the inflation that was emerging could be adequately addressed by monetary policy. And this started at the top with Arthur Burns, a great scholar, a great student and writer about the American business cycle, who didn't fully appreciate the way that monetary policy needed to be deployed to deal with inflation. So the first example with that is the first oil shock that occurred in the early 70s. It was a quadrupling of oil prices that came in the context of the OPEC embargo following the Arab-Israeli war. During that period, Burns believed that that was an outgrowth of geopolitical pressures brought to bear on oil markets and had nothing to do with what the Fed was doing. So he ordered us on the staff to strip out energy from the CPI so he could get a clean read on an underlying gauge that was amenable to monetary policy action. We did that. A few months later, food prices started surging. And Burns had done a lot of detective work, and he believed strongly that the food prices were traceable to a strange, unusual El Nino ocean current that had heated up the waters off the coast of Peru, destroyed a gazillion anchovies, who then played a critical role in the production of fertilizer and feedstocks that had adverse impacts on cattle and pig prices in the United States. And that's where the inflation was coming from. It had nothing to do with monetary policy, said Burns. Take it out. And at that point, we objected. He said, what do you mean? You can't. It's one thing to take out energy from the CPI. It's another thing to take out the food that people need to subsist. And I remember his words to this day. I was part of a group that he ordered us to do that. He said, if you don't take it out, I'll find someone in New York who will. And so we took it out because we didn't want to lose our jobs and unwittingly created a consumer price index that excluded food and energy. It was the first creation of what we now call the core CPI. Well, Burns didn't stop there. He kept taking more. He kept ordering us to take more and more stuff out to get a measure that was aligned with what he was trying to do on monetary policy. He took out home ownership. He took out women's jewelry because they were being inflated by speculative increases in gold prices, mobile homes, children's toys, you name it. By the time we were done, he had taken out more than half of the CPI, and that was rising at a double-digit rate. In the mid-1970s, and he finally recognized he had a problem. But it was too late by then because the inflationary pressures had gotten embedded into the system through cost of living escalation clauses in labor agreements. They got built into the wage structure, and inflationary expectations went crazy. And it really took an extraordinary tightening by Paul Volcker to find the level of interest rates that would make a difference in this devastating inflationary psychology. So the main problem of the 70s is the Fed didn't understand the process and didn't have the courage to do what it took to address the problem. And so we're nowhere near that today, but the earlier period of the post-COVID period where Jerome Powell, despite his appreciation of history and his good intentions, started dismissing these transitory outbreaks of inflation, was worrisome and strikingly reminiscent of the trauma that many went through inside of the Fed in the early 1970s.
There are also some macroeconomists, I'm not going to say names because I may misstate something slightly, and I don't want to do that to someone, but there are macroeconomists who've criticized the Fed's reaction by saying, yes, you're raising interest rates and that's the appropriate thing to do, but at a very slow pace. It looks fast compared to other periods when rates went up, but we're, as you just said, we are just beginning to get to the point now when the real interest rate is almost positive. Last time I checked, the real interest rate with inflation subtracted off of it is still negative by a fraction of 1%. But the direction is clear. It's going to turn positive shortly. But that'll be the first time in, 2 years of Fed activity that the real interest rate would have been at all positive. Back in Volcker's day, I checked some of the stats, and it looked to me like he was generating a real interest rate of something like 5%, a very significant difference between the federal funds rate and the inflation rate.
Yeah, I'm one of the ones who was certainly very critical of the Fed today by pounding the table in the early post-COVID period, saying that the nominal policy rate, which was still being held at a number just barely above zero, was well below not just the COVID distorted inflation, but what appeared to be a worrisome broadening out of inflationary pressures outside of the COVID supply shock. So interest rates in real terms, the policy rate plunged into negative territory more deeply than ever before than we had ever seen. Far worse than was the case during the Burns and early Volcker era. So I said, you better get those rates back up as quickly as you can. I think in retrospect, that advice was maybe a little too strong because, there was a period where Powell's Fed was raising their target policy rate by 0.75% each meeting. And they did that for four meetings in a row. That was very aggressive. And the holders of long-term treasury notes and bonds were in denial that the Fed would do that and were led to that belief by the denial of the Fed itself. And they took huge losses on their bond portfolios. And that's what sowed the seeds of the problems that the Silicon Valley Bank faced and a few other institutions have faced as well, calling the trade underwater bond positions that were not insured by any of these sophisticated hedges that can be put on to guard against the risk to bonds that occurs in a very different policy environment than the one we had become accustomed to.
Your recent essay reiterated your concerns about the Federal Reserve, but then it took a turn that I found very interesting, and it linked the discussion of our financial difficulties with the rise of China. And you have had a remarkable career. You left the Federal Reserve and I believe went to work for the Morgan Stanley Bank right out of the Federal Reserve. Is that right or wrong?
It's close.
It's close. Okay.
I spent 3 years out of the Fed at a place called Morgan Guaranty Trust Company, which is now known as JP Morgan. But that was 3 years. And then I joined Morgan Stanley in 1982, just when the Volcker medicine was starting to work and send inflation down and the economy roaring back into recovery and asset markets taking off on the heels of a phenomenal bull market in interest rates that now appears to have come to an end.
Just in time for Ronald Reagan to declare that it was all responsible. It was all his doing, and it's morning in America, and da-da-da-da. So Morgan Stanley, for folks who don't know, is an itsy-bitsy bank, about $143 billion current worth. It's one of the largest banks the globe has ever known. And you became chief economist of the bank.
Yeah, it was a great job. I started Morgan Stanley in 1982, 1,800 people, and I think three offices around the world. And when I retired and went into my Wall Street recovery program at Yale, the company had, I think, over 60,000 employees and so many offices, I can't even count them, but they're literally all over the world.
All right. I have to apologize for getting personal, but I have you in front of me. What does the chief economist of a massive bank like that do in a day? What is a day like? I simply don't connect to it.
Well, it was great. I mean, I can't say I loved every second of it, but I was able to come in 1982 when Morgan Stanley did not, you know, have any concept of what it was going to grow into. And there was no economics function. There was no economics newsletters or products. And so we got to create it from scratch. And I didn't fully realize it at the time, but I guess I have a strong entrepreneurial instinct. And I developed a style. I started writing about economics that was of interest to investor clients and corporate clients, developing products, figuring out how to put the dialogue, the debate out onto a new platform that no other economics team had ever used before, something called the internet, believe it or not. We had the first internet-based economic forum of any firm in the world. And, you know, we got to just figure it all out our way rather than inherit, you know, a pre-existing model or set of products that other institutions had a proprietary interest in and sort of wanted you to keep doing it their way. We did it a different way because the Morgan Stanley way needed to be created. The pivotal time for me came, Wally, in the late 90s. I had built an outstanding global economics team at Morgan Stanley. We had people all over the world, and there was a horrific financial crisis in Asia, and my Asian team had no idea what was going on. Again, we were ranked number one in the world in terms of global economics teams, but we didn't deserve that. Our forecast was in tatters, and we didn't know what was going to happen to this world afflicted by what some call the first crisis of modern globalization. So I started going out to China in late 97, having an instinct that China would hold the key to the end game of this crisis. And I'd been to China a few times, but I knew nothing about the place. And I started going every other month. And I figured out that China was not going to go down like, you know, Korea or Thailand or Indonesia, but was really going to come out of this crisis more powerful than anyone appreciated. And I got hooked on China and it changed my life. And I ultimately ended up giving up my day job in terms of tracking the U.S. economy, bore into China, and became Morgan Stanley's not just chief economist, but first chief global economist, and ultimately ended up moving out to Asia, you know, maybe 2007, 2008. And when it came time for me to think about this was sustainable, I got a teaching offer at Yale, and you know, the rest is history. Left Morgan Stanley, went to Yale, developed a lot of courses based on my knowledge and experience in Asia, and wrote three books, and here we sit today.
So you have a fascinating history of your assessment of where China is going. Let me just say, you began as a very much as an enthusiast of a lot of the things that were going on in China, but you changed your mind at some point. Will you walk us through that change that occurred in you?
Well, look, I have been a congenital optimist on China since I first discovered that it had the strategy, the wherewithal, and the commitment to not just avoid the Asian financial crisis of the late 1990s, but to set the nation, the most populous nation in the world, on this extraordinary development trajectory that we've never seen for a large economy. And I stayed optimistic, you know, in the late 90s, the early 2000s. There was a critical point in 2007 that I've written about in my books, where the then premier of China, a gentleman by the name of Wen Jiabao, challenged the leadership in China to think about the risks that were building, even though the economy was strong on the surface. Beneath the surface, Wen argued it was unstable, unbalanced, and ultimately unsustainable. And they developed a new strategy to deal with this critique. So the model they had, I thought, was brilliant, that in that it could lead to self-awareness and a course correction that they could adapt to the new circumstances as they emerged. But then Xi Jinping entered the equation in late 2012, and I was still optimistic. I really felt that he was going to take the concept of reforms to a different level and really energize the system. And at first that seemed to be correct, call me naive, but the first year of his leadership, 2013, he developed and enacted a very large agenda of reforms that promised a more powerful and dynamic Chinese system going forward. But beginning in 2014, the focus was initially on an anti-corruption campaign that ultimately turned into a political campaign for a consolidation of power. The tact of the debate shifted more from a market-based system espoused by Deng Xiaoping and his successors to one driven much more by ideology and the rigors of a Marxist approach to governance and economic organization, that then by the time 2017 rolled around, became emblazoned under the mantra of Xi Jinping thought, which now drives and shapes basically all aspects of the system. And this made me uneasy and worried. And I think the final shoe for me fell, though, was sort of early this year, we got a report from the Chinese Statistical Bureau that the population, which we knew was going to be declining at some point in the next several years, that decline had already started. The working age population was had been contracting since 2016, but the total population started falling. And I knew from my training and experience as somebody who followed Japan very carefully that when your population starts declining, the only way you can avoid a growth quagmire is to boost productivity. And the productivity dynamic under Xi Jinping, where he was drawing much greater support on low productivity state-owned enterprises, and then ultimately squeezed the high productivity private sector, especially the internet companies, the productivity outlook was not good, not able to offset the demographic headwinds. And so I've now turned much more cautious on China after 25 years of being very, very optimistic. And I have a lot of concerns about the medium-term growth prospects in China as a result, which are critically important for the nation and for a leader like Xi Jinping, whose legitimacy as a leader depends on his ability to deliver sustained rapid growth as his successors, as his predecessors did in the past, from Deng Xiaoping to Jiang Zemin to Hu Jintao.
So the issues we're discussing now on China are the heart and soul of your remarkable new book, The Accidental Conflict, in which you lay out your view that both China and the United States have serious misconceptions about the other and could sleepwalk, as it were, into serious conflict that neither side truly wants and could be devastating. It's a remarkable book. It is not a thin tome, and it's one of those books where you really have to read every sentence because they're packed with meaning. Your book also discusses a person who I think is probably known to six people in the country right now. That's an overstatement. But the ideologist who plays a role in your book, Wang Huning, tell us a bit about this gentleman and the role he's playing in contemporary China and why you singled him out for so much discussion in your book.
Well, Wang Huning played a role in linking Chinese governance to Marxist ideology for Jiang Zemin, for Hu Jintao, and now for Xi Jinping. So he's a bit of a surviving chameleon in that, you know, he can craft his ideology in ways that suits the different regimes and different leaders in China. He started out as an academic, but quickly became much more taken with the opportunities to apply his tools and his knowledge of ideology within the party structure. He wrote a remarkable book in 1991 based on a sabbatical that he took living in the United States. And I mention this now because it responds directly to the question that you asked, called America versus America. And it's out of print. I managed to get a copy in English from some out of stock, out of print.
You can purchase it today, but it's as you say, it's not a very slickly produced book.
No. And the book basically is a scathing indictment of the American system, our politics, our economics, and especially our sociology, and stressing many of the issues that we actually worry about today: income inequality, urban blight, and crime. On the basis of this book, that it was only a matter of time before America fell on its own sword and would lose its status as a great power. No one really paid much attention to it, honestly, until he emerged at the sort of the top of the ideological structure under Xi Jinping. He espoused a vision that his view of America in decline was coming into sharper and sharper focus, initially pointed out by the global financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, which convinced many, including sources would tell us, those extremely close to Xi Jinping, if not Xi Jinping himself, that this was China's moment to grab the brass ring as a global leader, provided it stayed on its own course of prosperity and development, because it could outstrip a declining America. And this view of a declining America is Wang Huning's signature in contributing to the ideological clash that many in Chinese leadership circles view as at the center of the U.S.-China conflict, the rising power doing battle with a declining ruling power. Some have framed it differently as the Thucydides trap. That's Graham Allison from Harvard. But central to either view, the historical view or the ideological view, is the notion that the ruling power, America, is in decline. And what I wrote about last month is that here we have another example of what could be a financial crisis that has drawn into question the integrity of our financial system and our banks, following a long and reckless period of monetary accommodation that we talked about earlier on in our discussion today, Wally, that reinforces the view of American decline and makes the Wang Huning approach to U.S. versus China look all the more compelling. Crisis after crisis that are made in America make the Wang Huning view all the more attractive to those who believe inside of China that this is China's time, its moment, its opportunity to assume the role of a global hegemon or global leader.
So China itself, though, faces serious issues, and you sketched some of them, beginning with the working age population, as you just said. It just sort of bears repeating, because I think to most Americans, we think of China as massive, billions of people, and we don't stop to think, is that increasing or decreasing? And it is a bit stunning that the working age population began to decline. What did you say, 2016?
Yes, it peaked in 2016. But and, here's the nub of it is, we have learned repeatedly that when your body of prime age ambitious workers starts to decline, that's a real problem for sustained economic growth, no matter how big your overall population is. Japan experienced the same phenomena about 20 years earlier than China did, and Japan has been struggling to grow ever since. And Japan's problems were compounded by policy errors and a lot of other institutional characteristics that in some cases are similar, in other cases different from China. But one thing we know about a declining working age population is when as the working age population starts to retire and age, they then require a lot of support from the social safety net that supports healthcare and retirement that any society needs to take care of its elderly generation. And there's a lot of material in your book that goes through the fact that China has underinvested in its social safety net. And that has led to a real state of imbalance in the economy where younger workers and their families, they save a lot, but they don't spend it on personal consumption as we might do to excess in the United States. But that's led to big imbalances in their economy. And until they face up to building a more robust and supportive safety net, then those imbalances are likely to continue. And that's a very worrisome aspect of the Chinese strain of the Japan problem.
So let's turn to what your thoughts have been on how China and the United States can avoid a collision course. You have very specific ideas. Lay it out for us, will you please?
Thank you. The book Accidental Conflict is a book about both countries individually, but most of all, a book about the relationship between them. And I argue that contrary to what we see every night on television or reading our newspapers, that America does not have a China problem. I also argue that China does not have an America problem. I was just back in China for the first time since COVID a few weeks ago, and the views are widespread that China has an America problem. What I argue in the book is that we both have a relationship problem that we've not addressed effectively over the years. We once had a very constructive relationship of engagement, and there is no trust. There is no engagement right now. And so the prescription that I propose at the end of the book says that a relationship problem needs a relationship solution. And so I'm very specific in identifying three legs to the stool for the relationship solution. The first one is, in fact, an agenda for rebuilding trust. Without trust, we can do nothing. So I draw up a list of action items that can be taken to rebuild trust. Some of them are easy, like opening consulates that both nations have closed in major cities, Chengdu in China, Houston in the United States. Restarting very popular and successful student foreign exchange programs. Relaxing visa requirements. These are easy things that can be done. Somewhat tougher is reducing the constraints that have been imposed on both by both sides on non-governmental organizations, NGOs, really bringing so many diverse aspects of civil society back together again as they used to be in building a trusting relationship. And then there are very ambitious but so critically important issues of mutual importance that we should both collaborate on, from climate change to global health to cybersecurity. I'm not naive enough to say that we can go from distrust to trust, but pick the low-hanging fruit first and start. And then I've got two other legs to the stool that are, I think, of great potential in conflict resolution. The second one is lower investment barriers in both countries by reaching agreement on a bilateral investment treaty. Multinationals that invest in each other's economies create jobs and connections and that feed into economic success. Instead, we have elected, as following the script of former President Trump, to focus on a phase one trade deal, as he called it, which is aimed at reducing the bilateral trade imbalance between our two countries, which ultimately accomplishes nothing. The tariffs he used did reduce some of the bilateral imbalance, but it spread to other countries, and our trade deficit is larger than ever. And the third leg of the stool is the one that I am most hopeful on. It's one that says we need a new architecture of engagement. We used to have meetings once or twice a year, depending on the administration in the United States, that held these big summits called strategic and economic dialogues. They were long on glitz, but short on substance. They accomplished nothing. And after the meetings were concluded, the exhausted officials and participants went back to their day jobs and held on until the next meeting occurred. I want a permanent organization staffed equally by American and Chinese professionals located in a neutral jurisdiction, call it Switzerland for lack of a better example, that has a broad remit focusing on all aspects of the relationship, from trade economics to innovation to subsidies of state-owned enterprises to health, climate, cyber, and even human rights. But I want this organization to operate not episodically around these big summits, but 24/7, full time. And they will be charged with developing approaches to solving thorny policy problems, mutual problems, based on a common database. The secretary would have a convening power to bring experts to help solve difficult problems, like COVID as an example. We still fight over the COVID origins debate. That's gotten us nowhere in terms of resolving this horrific pandemic. But the secretary could have convened experts, scientists, epidemiologists, public health practitioners to give us a much better collaborative understanding of what needed to be done to avoid the loss of millions of lives around the world. And finally, the Secretariat should have a dispute resolution function attached to it. So when inevitable frictions arise on agreements existing, the Secretary can help at resolving the problem. So that's my plan, Wally. Trust, a bilateral investment treaty, and a new Secretariat. It's not perfect, but at least it's a plan for two nations that are headed dangerously down a collision course that could result in, as the title of the book suggests, an accidental conflict. I want to avoid that at all costs, and I've got a proposal that I think addresses many of the risks associated with that otherwise dire outcome.
And it's strikingly different. I mean, to be blunt, the absolute pessimism on all sides that I hear when China is discussed, even those who try to follow in Trump's footsteps, and emphasize what they disagree with on China and how tough they would be if they were in the presidency, et cetera, et cetera. It still reeks of pessimism about what could possibly be accomplished. It's a reaction without much hope on its side. Your proposal, let me just throw this hardball at you, that stuff like that cannot be achieved by one political party in our current setup, where both parties are astonishingly weak. That's going to require, and anything like that is going to require unity in our own country, a vision that's embraced by the vast majority of Americans and endorsed by the leaders of both political parties. Do you see the seeds of that anywhere?
No, I don't. And I'm, you know, I've been accused of being hopelessly naive. I was in London last week, and a good friend of mine, very famous economist and a former high official in the Clinton administration, who I will not identify by name, said, "This is, you know, I like your framework of understanding the conflict, but your solution is pathetically naive." And I take that as encouragement. Because the view of the you know, the so-called experts in political economy and policy have no appetite for engagement, and if we don't have the vision to rethink that and the courageous leadership to do something unpopular, then we won't reengage, and accidental conflict becomes the reality of what could be the next kinetic war. And so we have to make a choice. And, you know, we've had courageous leaders who have gone against the political grain. And I'm holding out, still hold out hope, call me naive if you want, that there will come a day when one of our political leaders starts to stand up, not appeasement, but for re-engagement with China. When you speak the word re-engagement right now, when it comes to the U.S.-China conflict, you are vilified as being almost treasonous. And that is an absolute certain recipe for accidental conflict and war, in my opinion.
Well, let me permit me some optimism. I noticed in the way you structure your three proposals, it starts with cooperating on some pretty obvious stuff. Let's just take climate change. Pretty obvious stuff that we could cooperate on. And if we don't cooperate on, wow, is there any chance that climate change really will be dealt with? And it goes on then to avoid trade strategies that are destructive to both nations, and then culminates in the Secretariat for the relationship. The first one is ambitious, but is the most modest of the three proposals. And I assume you saw that as the entry point, that is the idea of finding obvious things for us to work on, things that cannot succeed globally without the two of us at the table with each other, leading the rest of the world, have no hope of solution whatsoever. Climate change foremost among them. That strikes me as something that, you know, perhaps the person wouldn't say a darn thing. You know, the American politician wouldn't say anything about China whatsoever. It would be all about climate change and how we're going to deal with it. And yet in it would be the seeds of rebuilding a relationship.
Yeah, that's, look, without trust, there's no hope. And so I do start with an agenda, taking little steps and hopefully some big steps in dealing with climate or health in this COVID era that are urgent for both nations to work together on to resolve. And, you know, when we work hard collectively on problems, that is what sows the seeds of trust building. And I think those are opportunities that we can't afford to squander as Americans. The Chinese can't afford to squander as Chinese. And the world needs us to work together and to collaborate. Climate is a natural, given China's extraordinary expertise in building the technologies and the infrastructure of non-carbon alternative energy. They still have a horrific pollution problem, but they are tackling it. And, you know, we certainly recognize the urgency of tackling climate change, and who better to partner with than the world's largest greenhouse source of greenhouse emissions, who is actively moving ahead in alternative energies, as China.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. For those of you who are listening, Accidental Conflict is a great way to learn your way into a whole raft of American history and Chinese history and the relationship between the two. I can't recommend it highly enough. Thanks very much for coming on the podcast today, Steve.
Thank you, Wally. It's a pleasure to speak with you.